The climate is changing. So are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, March 24th on CBC Radio. Experts warn that Gaza and Haiti are on the brink of famine. First up, we'll examine what that really means and what needs to be done to stop mass starvation. After that, many celebrated her as a feminist icon. Others scrutinized her motivations. In a Canadian exclusive interview, Christine Blasey Ford will share her experience testifying of alleged sexual assault against now U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Also today, former CBC News London Bureau Chief Anne McMillan will tell us what may lie ahead for the royal family after the Princess of Wales cancer diagnosis. We'll also bring you the latest on the deadly Moscow concert hall attack. And later, Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Call on what Saddam Hussein's secret recordings reveal about today's authoritarian leaders. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. Time is running out for some of the most vulnerable people in Gaza, which is facing what's being described as the world's worst hunger crisis. A new United Nations-backed report says famine in the northern part of Gaza is imminent. It also stated that up to half the population of all Gazans, that's 1.1 million people, are expected to face catastrophic levels of hunger and starvation by July. Meanwhile, there continue to be stark warnings of severe hunger elsewhere in our world. Global watchdogs say countries mired in civil conflict, including Sudan and Haiti, are also at high risk. Alex Duvall is one of the world's leading experts on famine. He's the executive director of the World Peace Foundation, and he's the author of the book, Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. Alex Duvall, good morning. It's nice to have you with us.
Good morning.
You have been studying famine for 4 decades now, and you wrote a piece back in 2016 in the New York Times saying there might be a chance the world could see the end of large-scale famines. What made you assess it that way 8 years ago? What made you think that might be possible?
So I was pretty optimistic then. What we'd seen during the 20th century was major famines in the first 7 decades of the 1900s. And then a very rapid decline to almost vanishing point. And part of this was due to greater food production, more efficient markets, poverty reduction, etc. But the greater part of the decline was due to the fact that the political causes of famine, which were war, and especially the use of starvation as a weapon of war, and totalitarian governments that inflicted starvation on their own people and concealed that fact, those were disappearing. So I was hopeful that that, combined with a better and larger, more professional international humanitarian system, meant that this was one global problem that we had decisively solved. Hmm.
And some 8 years later, that is not the case.
No, I was wrong. Clearly, famines are back. We're not back to the most dreadful days, but we have seen over the last 4 or 5 years in particular an increasing number, intensity, and lethality of famine. So sadly, the topic that I'd hoped I had consigned to history, to an early part of my career, is back.
Let's talk about the word famine itself. It does have a technical designation. So can you tell me what that is and how famines are classified?
So back in the day, a famine was simply classified as a period of acute food crisis, when normal food supplies collapsed, when certain groups of people in society just didn't have what was needed to grow or buy enough food to keep them alive. And there was no standardized definition. But about 20 years ago, a number of humanitarian experts got together and they designed what is, it's a mouthful, it's called the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System, or IPC for short. And this has five levels. And if you look at their website or the website of the US government's Famine Early Warning System, FUSENET, you'll see them colored. So there's a green color for when things are pretty much normal, yellow when food security is stressed, goes into sort of an orangey brown color, which is crisis, which is when humanitarians begin to get concerned, red, which is emergency. And that's when children start to die from hunger and disease, because disease is actually very often the bigger killer. Children, when they are malnourished, get susceptible to waterborne diseases and pneumonia and so on. And then the last sort of dark blood red is famine itself. And things have to be really desperately bad for a famine diagnosis to be made. And in fact, only twice prior to Gaza, only twice in the last 20 years has this actually been done, once in Somalia in 2011, once in South Sudan in 2017.
You mentioned children being, you know, very vulnerable when there is starvation and when there is hunger and when there is famine. We have, over the course of history, seen so many devastating images in the news showing people experiencing extreme hunger. Can you just kind of briefly, like, walk me through what actually happens to a human body at a severe level of malnutrition?
Well, let's talk primarily about children. About anywhere between half and three quarters of those who perish in a famine are children under the age of five. And they're, you know, they have smaller bodies, they need greater nutritional and special nutritional needs. And they, what happens is you use up your body fat very quickly, so that you see children looking like old people. Their skin contracts, gets wrinkled, and the bones show, and the ribs show. And quite often they get a famine bloating, edema. They get these round, swollen bellies. But also they get very susceptible to infectious diseases. Their immune systems begin to collapse. And so even a relatively mild episode of diarrhea can lead to very, very dangerous dehydration. And if children are not given the right sorts of nutritional food supplements and enough water with sugar and salt, so they can very, very quickly pass away from really what would otherwise be very minor infections.
There are also impacts that are less visible. Those are the mental toll that famine takes on individuals and communities. How does a famine impact in that way?
Well, famine is also a social trauma. So think about what it means for a family to be put under this stress, where the survival of every member of the family, especially the children, suddenly comes into doubt. So what families tend to do is they, you know, sell possessions. They may sell treasured heirlooms that have been handed down for generations. They may sell their land, their most precious assets, like, you know, if they're farmers, they may sell plows and or draft oxen or whatever. And they usually sell these at a pittance because food prices have gone up, and everyone is selling what they have. They may be forced to abandon their homes. And then in extremis, you get this terrible situation where mothers are forced to choose. If you have only money enough to treat one of your two or three children, or, you know, you are cooking your food and your hungry neighbors or your, you know, hungry nephews and nieces come to the door and you want to conceal that food, or you turn them away. And so it's these little shameful, undignified and cruel acts that linger in the minds of people for the rest of their lives, and indeed for generations. And if you think about how historic famines are remembered or memorialized, it's very striking that the Irish famine, the Great Hunger in Ireland, or as some call it, the Great English Famine in Ireland, because it was inflicted by the English, it struck in the 1840s, but it wasn't for more than 100 years that the first public memorials began to be built.
You're listening to The Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Alex Duvall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation. Alex is also the author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. Alex, let us zoom in to the situation in Gaza. You know, a few minutes ago, you outlined sort of the classification system that is used now worldwide to categorize how hunger is. Just to put the Gaza situation in that context, the latest report by the IPC that does this classification says that northern Gaza is in phase five, which is famine with reasonable evidence, with 70% of the population in this sort of catastrophic stage. In southern Gaza, in Khan Yunis and Rafah, classified as that emergency stage. I think you said that was red. For its part, the Israeli government, the foreign minister Israel Katz, lashed out at accusation that Israel is deliberately causing hunger in Gaza, saying Israel allowed, quote, extensive humanitarian aid into Gaza by land, air and sea for anyone willing to help. And Israel also blames Hamas for preventing the food from getting to Gazans. What is your perspective about what is happening inside Gaza?
Well, the first point to make is that as of now, with more than 650,000 people in phase five, that's about well over a third of the population, we have never seen anything like this since these scales were first created. The next worst famine was Somalia, 2011, with 490,000 people in that phase. And that famine cost 250,000 lives. So this is the worst by sheer numbers. It's the worst by proportion of the population. It's also the worst by the speed at which a population that was relatively well-nourished 6 months ago has been reduced to this state. So it is without precedent in modern times. And I cannot emphasize that enough. If we look at Gaza in comparative historical perspective, it is the worst, and it is entirely man-made. On the question of responsibility, the definition of the war crime of starvation is the destruction of objects indispensable for the survival of the human population. And the number one driver of this disaster is the destruction of food, clean water, medical facilities, shelter, sanitation, etc., and driving people from their homes. The secondary element is the restriction of food and food aid. And according to a parallel report by the US government, a famine early warning system that measure basically every calorie that goes in into Gaza, because it was 99% dependent on food imports, even before the war. They estimate that the food that is going in by truck and by sea and by air is less than 50% of what is needed to sustain life. And all the food reserves and local food production has either been destroyed or used up. So it's simply not true that enough is going in or enough is being permitted in, because we see these long, long lines of trucks at the border. And the airdrops, you know, an airdrop with all the aircraft that go on a particular day, only delivers 2 truckloads worth of food, whereas more than 200 trucks are needed to feed the population of Gaza.
As you've outlined, this Gaza situation is grim. But you also say that the hotspot of the food crisis is actually in the region near the Red Sea, not too far away, but countries including Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, and Yemen. Why are all these countries facing a similar crisis now?
So the scale of the crisis in these countries is much greater. They're not, not yet at least, as acute as Gaza. But if you take Sudan, a population of 45 million people, more than half the population of Sudan, 25 million people, need food aid. They are projected to be majority in phase 4 emergency in the coming months. The situation in parts of Ethiopia is just as bad, in Yemen, just as bad, South Sudan, just as bad. Now, this comes about through a mixture of conflict. The use of starvation as a weapon, the deliberate or reckless destruction of agricultural infrastructure, the blocking of commercial and humanitarian supplies. And in the background, there is the climate crisis. It's not the immediate trigger. The politics is the immediate trigger, but there is a climate factor, no doubt, contributing to all of this.
And that is why you say all modern famines are directly or indirectly man-made, isn't it?
That's correct. I mean, we haven't had a sort of purely natural disaster famine for well over 100 years. It's at the very minimum, it is government neglect and indifference that causes famine. Famine is eminently soluble. There is absolutely no reason why we should have famines in the modern world.
As you well know, there are a lot of calls to get more aid into Gaza. And if we look at the brutal civil war in Sudan, relief agencies are saying that this appeal for humanitarian aid has reached less than 5% of its target. What should be the role of the world, especially from Western countries like ours, be in times of conflict? How do we provide help in a responsible manner?
So the humanitarian system is far from perfect. It can be slow, it can be creaky, etc. But it's the only one we've got. Now, one of the things that's most shocking at the moment is that the world's largest provider of humanitarian food, that is the World Food Programme, is facing cuts of 30% at this very moment when it is more needed than ever. They're having to lay off many of their staff in critical countries from Afghanistan to Sudan and at headquarters because of a funding crisis. And the largest reason for that is the United States is not, that the US Congress is not passing the supplemental budget, which would provide the essential humanitarian relief. And other donors are simply not stepping up either. So we have this terrible situation whereby needs are going up, costs are also going up, food and transport are more expensive, and the amount of money available is shrinking very rapidly.
When we look at around the world, food is prevented from getting to the people who most desperately need it, as you say, by governments, by conflict and the dangers of that. In the case of Haiti, being hijacked by militias, the danger caused by armed gangs. There are some people who say, well, the best way to get food into many places is to bring in the military. So should countries in the West especially be sending in soldiers to safeguard the caravans that potentially could carry in aid?
The military can have a role, but its role is often very exaggerated, and its efficacy and its efficiency by those who advocate for it, because the military tend to be extremely expensive. They tend to prioritize protecting themselves, and they tend to generate local hostility wherever they go. There are actually much more effective and efficient ways of providing aid in these circumstances, using private contractors, using cash, for example, money transfers, and using local agencies humanitarian agencies that usually have a lot of skill and capacity for delivering under very difficult circumstances. So the military is I think very much a last resort, and its potential tends to be overstated.
Alex, we began our conversation of you saying how hopeful you were some 8 years ago and how the world has changed so much and how the situation of humans going hungry and starving in parts of the world has changed so much. Is there still a part of you, though, that is hopeful that somehow, some way, that we could turn this around? Or are we doomed to see these mass famines for human history?
I don't think we're doomed at all. There's plenty of food in the world. There's actually an overproduction of food. There's an agreement across the world about starvation being unacceptable. UN Security Council resolutions, which were voted for only recently, a few years ago, but including by China and Russia and others, they supported them, saying that starvation of civilians in war can be a crime. So it just requires a basic normative consensus. This is unacceptable. And then I think we could be back on the track that we were on until very recently of abolishing famines for good.
Alex Duvall, we always appreciate so much you helping us understand this better. And I do hope sometime in the future that we talk with you about how there is no famine in the world. Appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
You are very welcome.
Alex Duvall is Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation. He is also the author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. Now, the name Christine Blasey Ford may conjure an image for you of a woman wearing a navy blue suit with her right hand raised, standing before the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, surrounded by a sea of cameras.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
In 2018, the psychology professor gave testimony saying she was sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh when they were both teenagers. That testimony was part of the hearings to confirm Kavanaugh as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, where he now sits. He vehemently denied the allegations and accused Christine Blasey Ford of, quote, totally and permanently destroying his family and his reputation. For Christine Blasey Ford, her words gripped the world and changed her life forever. Many heralded her as a symbol of the Me Too movement. Others questioned her motivations and her credibility. Some sent her death threats. Now she is sharing her experience of her story in a memoir. It is called One Way Back. It explores the events leading up to her famous testimony and how it has shaped her life ever since. Christine Blasey Ford joins me in this Canadian exclusive interview. Christine Blasey Ford, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, I just described how the world came to know you. You, of course, are much more than that image of you testifying in 2018 that has come to define you in the public eye. But I want to take a step back with you. Before 2018, how would you describe the woman known as Chrissy Blasey?
Well, I had a pretty good life. I was a university professor working hard from August till June and then spending 9 weeks every summer on the beach and in the ocean. Serious at work and more fun outside of work.
Sounds good. sounds good to me. And you said you spent a lot of time in the water in the summers because you are a surfer, and you write about sort of the analogies between surfing and your experience in your book. So here you are, the professor, the mother, the surfer, a person who was also carrying something else with her for many years, and it came to the surface in 2018. You were 52 years old at the time. You describe being on the beach, you're hanging out with a couple of your friends, your kids are playing in the water, and almost nonchalantly, you say to your friends that you had been attacked by a man who was being considered, or at least sort of thrown around his name at the time, to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. I know there was a lot of steps beyond that, but can you take us through the steps from making that disclosure to taking it beyond telling your close friends and your husband?
So in that initial week when his name was being tossed around, there were a list of candidates who all looked equally qualified and had equal viewpoints. And I had very, what I thought, important information about one of the candidates. And I felt that it was my civic duty to share that information as quickly as possible. Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and this sense of patriotism from spending, you know, childhood and middle school field trips to the Supreme Court and to Congress and visiting those places many times, taking my own children to see those places. And I just very much revered those institutions and think of the Supreme Court as where we send the best of the best.
And so you tell your friends and you say to yourself, I've got a responsibility, a civic duty, as you say, to take this forward. What's the next decision you make?
The next decision was to call my U.S. representative, and before the selection was made. So I called her office, and then I also put in an anonymous tip to one of our major news outlets.
So you shared your story with the Washington Post. I'm not throwing that out there. You name him in your book, your Congresswoman, Anna Eshoo. And you eventually also write a letter to then-Senator Dianne Feinstein. In reaching out to those various people and publication in one instance, what did you hope might come from that?
Well, I hoped that they would take the information and share it and decide whether they deemed it important to consider for this very important position. And I felt a sense of urgency about it. I'm not sure that they felt the same sense of urgency that I felt.
Yeah, how did they respond?
Well, they advised me to write the letter and then advised me to hire attorneys, which then I did. And I did that, and then I underwent a polygraph test. I didn't really understand why I needed lawyers. I hadn't done anything wrong, and I simply wanted to relay information that I thought was useful to try to help the people who were making the decision.
And as you're sort of getting these opinions and advice from various people, are you at any point saying to yourself, you know what, forget it, this ain't worth it, I'll just go on with my life?
Well, I had no idea I was going to end up one day on television, so I thought this was all going to play out privately and that maybe there would be a private meeting with senators or officials who were considering the vote on him. And so I was going forward thinking that it was going to be a private situation, not a public situation. It wasn't terrifying until I knew that it was going to be a public situation. So.
Yeah, and as things progress, you describe that your lawyers advised you not to go public and make your identity more known, saying, as you write, quote, we can't let you stand in front of an oncoming train. What did you think was behind that warning? Like, what did you think when you heard those words might happen if you did come forward?
I took that to mean that in some ways the outcome was predestined and that there was nothing that I could do about it and that the information would have no bearing on how he would be considered. It was a little bit disappointing because I, of course, thought the information was really important, but I also didn't know that much about the rest of his life, and I only knew my experience with him, and I thought that that was sufficient to at least consider.
You did eventually make your identity known. You came forward after your name had been leaked to the media. And then in time, the Senate Judiciary Committee holds these additional public hearings to discuss your allegations. So there you are, like on September 27th, 2018, the day the world met you, the day you stood in committee to give your testimony. There were millions and millions of people who tuned into this televised event in your country and around the world. And I remember clearly when you began to speak, you could hear the emotion in your voice. As you sort of sit here, you know, 6 years later, how do you remember that day?
I remember walking down the hallway and knowing there was no turning back. And I was just trying to make it to the chair. And once I sat in the chair, I was looking up at the seal of the United States. And I was quite in awe and also quite overwhelmed by the setting. But I had to just take it one question at a time, and I didn't have the opportunity to be too scared. I had to just manage what was directly in front of me. I guess, leaned on my sense of patriotism, my sense of doing the right thing, the way I'd been raised, and that I was telling the truth, and I had to detach from the outcome because that was just too stressful to think about. So that was really helpful to just detach from the outcome and not be invested too much in that part.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Christine Blasey Ford about her new memoir. It is called One Way Back. Your allegations and testimony led people to paint you in very different lights. Many have celebrated and continue to celebrate you as a feminist icon. Others tried and continue to try to poke holes in your credibility. Some have accused you of having ulterior political motivations. How did that frenzy about you affect your life in the weeks and months following your testimony?
It was actually years that it affected me. It was very difficult for me to grapple with both of those things. And very scary. My family, we were living away from home. It wasn't safe to be at home. So we were gone for 3.5 months and living with security detail. We were protected by them. And then the psychological impact of it was quite difficult. But on the other hand, I had this outpouring of support from all 50 states and 42 countries, handwritten letters that were just so powerful and heartwarming and heartbreaking, and boxes of letters from Canada. So I really appreciate everyone, those of you who wrote a letter and all the people who thought about writing a letter. The people from Canada were incredibly supportive and buoyed me through that very difficult period.
We're going to get back to those letters and talk a little bit more about the impact they've had on you. But I want to take us back to that moment, because we're in 2018. This is your testimony, you coming forward. It's all happening on the backdrop of the Me Too movement, that period that illustrated the extent of sexual violence happening to women around the world. And whether you wanted to or not, you became a sort of symbol of this moment. And you describe and you write about worrying about not being a quote unquote perfect women's rights advocate. Tell me more about that concern and how this sort of complicated the whole situation for you.
Well, at the time when I was testifying, I wasn't really thinking about the Me Too movement. It wasn't like in my conscious mind that I was part of that movement until afterwards. Then I started to connect strongly with that community. I was thinking I was more of just a person who was a letter of non-recommendation for the candidate. I did worry about my imperfections, and I describe them all in the book, and the things that I had done in my life and how that might be twisted and used against me, and that I've seen it play out with other assault survivors and other people who step forward and testify for other causes, that there's this immediate reaction called DARVO, where the accuser is discredited and they reverse the victim and the offender, and it becomes, I ruined his life, so I become the offender and he becomes the victim. And it's just a playbook that's used so often that it's very predictable.
Did you think at the time, like, I know probably how this is going to go?
Yes, I had this thought that, well, people would say to me, they're going to ruin your life. So it wasn't like I wasn't warned, but that's a really abstract thing to say to people. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book, is to make it a little more concrete for anybody else that might be out there in this situation and wondering, what does that really mean? Because, you know, they're not going to kill you, but they're going to do things that are going to make your life really difficult. And I underestimated that greatly. I thought it meant that people back in Washington, D.C. would call me the B word or something, and I wouldn't really maybe even know about it, but that I would lose some friends, you know, certainly any friends that overlapped with his friend group. So I just really underestimated what that would look like.
And as much as you feel comfortable telling me, what did that look like, the pushback and the hate?
Well, there was quite a bit of smear media and smear books accusing me of things, from being a drug dealer to other types of business fraud and just things I could never have imagined ahead of time. It was quite upsetting, I have to say. The one thing I did that I'm glad that I did was that before I came forward, I checked with my employers and asked them if they thought this would have any bearing on my employment. And they said not at all. And I feel very privileged and grateful that I'm in the position to speak. And it almost made it, that was almost a motivation and made it even more of a duty that I should speak, given that not everyone can do that.
You wrote that you think that most people believed what you described happened to you, but Brett Kavanaugh, who denied it, still got the job on the Supreme Court. And you write, Christine Blasey Ford, quote, "The strange part was that it didn't feel like I hadn't been heard. It felt like I had been believed, but then the response was a proverbial shrug."
I guess it was foreshadowed by my attorney saying the train is going where it's going. And they were right. It was going to go there no matter what I had said that day and no matter how compelling the testimony was.
You know, when I read the book, and I think when many other people read the book, you put yourself as a reader into, like, would I step away at this time? Would I go forward? What would I do, you know, as you go through that? And you describe, and you've been talking about the internal conflict you dealt with about coming forward, saying both that you regret it and that you would do it all over again, which on first blush sounds like two things in opposition. So help me understand that more. How do you hold both of those feelings at the same time?
Well, I would absolutely do it again. I still have the same sense of commitment to the United States and the same sense of civic duty. And so, of course, I would do it again. And I also realized the impact it had on other survivors. So if my one life was damaged in some way, that's one life. And it helped, if it helped so many people to be validated or heard, and that we heard from them in the letters, and they were in turn also validating me, then of course I don't regret it.
Let's talk about those letters. There are 100,000 of them, personal messages, handwritten, that you've gotten since you testified. There's this photo of, in the book, of you surrounded by these tens of thousands of handwritten letters. You categorize them, haven't you?
Yes, I've sorted them by country, by gender, by assault survivor, Me Too stories versus patriotic citizen letters. So 24% of the letters were from survivors who detailed their own experiences with assault.
What does that, those letters mean to you?
Everything. Everything. They are how I got through and how my family got through the ordeal, was this incredible outpouring of support from all over the country and all over the world.
And so, beyond you and your family, as you say, they offer great personal support and helped you all get through. But what does that also tell you about where we're at with the reckoning around sexual assault and abuse today?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress and we have a long way to go. So there's a lot more to be done at the structural level. And I think that we need to make it safer for survivors to come forward and help those that are trying to come forward. And one way we could do that is to try to establish protections where people can't retaliate against, the government should not be able to retaliate against people trying to help them.
And in the opening of your book, as you mentioned the letters, you say this is for all the letter writers.
Absolutely. It's a huge thank you. I wish I could write to them individually. And I started and tried to, and I wrote back to all the people who are over 90 years of age, and that took me so long. And I thought, oh, even if I spend every day doing this, I won't necessarily be able to get to everyone. So this is my first thank you to them, and hopefully there'll be other ways that I can thank them as well.
More than 30 years ago, lawyer Anita Hill stood before the Senate Judiciary Committee giving her own testimony about an alleged sexual assault by Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas, who of course sits on the bench. People have drawn so many similarities between your experiences, and you talk about her in the book as well. Whether it's in a hall of power or a workplace hallway, what do you want people to take away from your story as we collectively and individually continue to navigate these issues?
Well, I think people need to remember that whether they're on my side or not, that's okay, but they can't turn away from the fact that 1 in 3 women are sexually assaulted and there's no sign of that epidemic abating, and we need to address that. Also, to your point about Dr. Hill, about Anita, I don't know that I ever would have come forward if it wasn't for her, because it was so automatic in my mind that I needed to say something. And then when I reflect back, why would it be so automatic? It's because I saw someone else do that. So of course, that's what you're supposed to do if someone else has already paved that pathway and set that example and you have similar information. So that was extremely inspiring for me.
My first question was to you was to tell me about Chrissy as you were known, and you went by your name, Blasey, and then officially you had to become Christine Blasey Ford, which is how we all came to know you. And I asked you about that image that we all know of that woman in a Navy suit on that day in 2018. I'm wondering how you see that woman now.
Well, I'm proud of what I did, and I certainly paid a cost. And it was really difficult, and I continue to pay a little bit for it, and I'm willing to pay for it. Our wrangling with these kinds of situations, it is survivable, and you can rebuild your life. And in some ways, rebuilding your life is a bit of a gift. And I wish a lot of people could have that gift without all the crisis that makes that happen. But it is quite a gift to be able to rebuild your life with intention.
I so appreciate you talking to me. I know it's difficult. And as you say, no matter where people stand on issues and how they view you, that coming forward takes a lot of courage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Christine Blasey Ford's new memoir is called One Way Back. You can read more about this story by going to our website, cbc.ca/Sunday.
I'm Nala Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Let us turn our attention to news from the royal family. On Friday, the Princess of Wales put the rumors of her whereabouts and the circumstances that have led to them to rest. In a video message, Kate Middleton announced that she has cancer and is undergoing preventative chemotherapy. It follows major abdominal surgery she had 2 months ago. Her diagnosis and disclosure have led to many more questions about her own health and also about what it may all mean for the royal family's duties. Anne McMillan is the author of Kings and Queens, The Real Lives of the English Monarchs. And many of you, of course, will know Anne as a former longtime London Bureau Chief for CBC News. Anne, good morning to you.
Good morning, Pia.
Of course, millions of people around the world are diagnosed with cancer every year. But this announcement from the Princess of Wales seemed to catch, I don't know, a lot of people off guard. So 2 days since that announcement, how are people in the United Kingdom taking in this news?
Well, I think the shock has been replaced by deep sympathy and admiration. And I'll just read you a few of the headlines here. Lots of Sunday newspapers in the UK. And the Sunday Express headline is "A Nation Touched by Kate's Courage." The Sunday Times says Kate wrote every word to reassure the nation. And her talk was 2 minutes and 15 seconds long. We're told she did it all in one take. The BBC filmed it. The Daily Star captures some of the mood with the headline, "Now They Are Sorry." And that, of course, is because there were so many weird conspiracy theories about what was going on with Kate.
Let's not talk about the conspiracy theories themselves, but sort of the lead up to her announcement on Friday. She had been out of the public eye for months. the royal said she would be after that abdominal surgery. She was supposed to return after Easter. But then she, you know, there was that photo with her and her kids, which she admitted she had photoshopped. And then the speculation, the conspiracy theories, as you say, the distrust. So when she put out this video, she also said she wanted to wait until their three young children are on Easter break, which they are now, so they could get some privacy and make this news public. But given all the lead up to this end, to what extent do you think, quote, all is forgiven, so to speak, or is there sort of lingering damage for the royals?
Well, I think people are asking about the role of Kensington Palace, which is the Prince and Princess of Wales base and the press office there, because they failed to quell the rumors. Now, the royals have in the past stuck to a idea that you never explain and you never complain and you never explain. But in these days, it's impossible to keep doing that with social media. And there are a lot of questions being asked about why Kensington Palace didn't quell the rumors. They felt that, you know, the Mother's Day photo, the UK Mother's Day photo, would have quelled some of those rumors, but then they didn't protect Kate when it turned out that she had played around with some of the editing, as so many of us do with our photographs. Mm. One observer said that they hung her out to dry. Mm. And this, I think, Pia, reflects also a lack of communication between Kensington Palace and Buckingham Palace, which is Prince Charles's main office. And the past few years, especially when Prince William and his father, Charles, didn't get on very well, there were a lot of mix-ups. Things have improved, but rumor has it that Buckingham Palace did not even know about the ill-fated UK Mother's Day photo being released. So a lot of work to be done there.
And so given all that, Anne, and as you say, look, times have changed. You can't just close the doors and not say anything anymore in this modern day. Now that Kate has put out this message, you know, she revealed some information. She has cancer. She started preventative chemotherapy, the reasons of the timing, and that she wants privacy. She did not disclose what form of cancer she has, which is understandable in terms of anyone in making that choice, what you want to say. But it has raised more questions. So how are you sort of assessing now the amount of information being disclosed?
Well, it's quite interesting because in the past, we really didn't know much about what was happening with royal health. The Queen was very ill by the end of her life, and every time that questions were asked, Buckingham Palace would say, if she didn't turn up for something, oh, she has mobility problems. And they would say things like, she's resting comfortably. And we don't even know what she died of, really, Pia, because there was no mention of anything other than old age. Mm. Same with Prince Philip, her husband. The fact that Prince Charles announced in February that he had cancer, but he didn't do it in person. He did it as a press release. No mention of what kind of cancer or what stage it was at. So Kate's intervention on Friday is quite unique in my experience because she actually is telling us in person, we can see her, that she's not well. Now, again, you're right. She didn't tell us exactly what was wrong with her, but she made it clear that she's having chemotherapy, which is something that Charles hasn't talked about at all. And that she really is doing it partly to protect her family, obviously, but also just to let other people who have cancer know that she's with them.
Yeah. A spokesperson from Kensington Palace said that Kate will return to official duties when she's cleared to do so by her medical team. She also said that. But for now, at least, Anne, as she's out and the King has cancer as well, there are now two high-profile members, senior royals, dealing with cancer. And of course, this also affects the Queen and the Prince of Wales and the children of the Prince and Princess of Wales. They're all impacted by this as well. What does this mean for the work of the royals?
Well, it is very interesting because Charles made a big thing about slimming down the royalty. And it was interesting when Adrian Arsenault, our own Adrian Arsenault, interviewed Princess Anne before the coronation, Princess Anne saying, a slimmed down monarchy was said in a day when there were a few more people around. And the average age of the main players these days is 72. So Kate is obviously, and William are just huge players in this group because they're young and they, you know, people can relate to them in a way that they don't relate to older people. One thing that's happened here is that Camilla, who has traditionally not been terribly keen to be in the limelight, has really stepped up. I'm going to boast here for a moment because my husband and I were at a posh party a while ago, not a while ago, 3 weeks ago. And Camilla was there. She came, even though Charles obviously isn't going out, which I thought was interesting. And she went round and talked to everybody. And when I sort of said, well done, we're seeing a lot of you, it's great. She said, someone has to do it. And she's very funny, actually, this woman. And she said, onwards and upwards. So, I mean, she's really come into her own. Princess Anne, of course. Oh, my goodness. She last year, she was the most active royal, 73 years old. She made 457 appearances. And she is also stepping up, too. So they're going to make it work. They'll probably do a bit less than they have in the past. William is going to get back into action after the children's school holiday, which ends in 3 weeks. And Kate has said she'll get back into the public life as soon as she can, but clearly not, as she originally said, after Easter. She'll have to take a longer time because, of course, when she said after Easter, she didn't realize she had cancer.
British royalty has been around for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And I'm just wondering, is there any historic parallel to this in terms of so many royals having to dial down their duties?
Not really. I mean, certainly in our lifetime. And when they were not well, nobody really told us. I mean, the Queen Mother apparently had cancer twice before she died. We didn't really realize, nobody told us that until after she had died. Her husband actually had lung cancer, and the doctors didn't even tell him he had lung cancer until they actually had to remove part of his lung. And they didn't tell the public. They just said his post-operative condition is satisfactory. So I think probably the royals in olden times didn't perhaps do as many public appearances as our present royal family does. But it's very unusual. Certainly in my experience in Britain, which is a long, as you mentioned, quite a long time here, I have never known two royals to be out of action so publicly.
And you also know, Anne, as a Canadian, that there are Canadians that don't give a hoot about this, and there are Canadians that are obsessed, and a lot of people in between. But here's the thing that, no matter how you view the royals, is common. The royal family needs to be visible. The late Queen said it was important if they were to be believed and believed in. And I wonder how much of this is a setback toward that goal?
Well, certainly in the UK, I can't speak for Canada, but I think that this has actually raised affection for the monarchy. I mean, Prince Charles is still working. We see him in pictures meeting people and meeting the prime minister and talking to various cabinet ministers. And people love Kate. I mean, she is, practically on the front page of a newspaper every single week when she's well. I think that it actually has made people actually value the royal family more than they might have done. When the Queen died, there was a great question about whether Charles would be able to carry on the love that people had for the Queen, Elizabeth. And I think that actually he is doing that. And I think the way he's handling his cancer is part of that.
Anne McMillan, it is always so great to hear your voice. Appreciate you and your analysis so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Pia. Lovely to talk to you.
Anne McMillan is the former London Bureau Chief for CBC News. She's also the author of Kings and Queens, The Real Lives of the English Monarchy. Today is a national day of mourning across Russia. At least 133 people were killed, another 140 injured when gunmen stormed the Crocus Concert Hall on Friday night. An evening out to hear a rock band ended in gunfire, flames, and tragedy. A number of people have been arrested, and a branch of the Islamic extremist group ISIS is claiming responsibility for the attacks. But there are other accusations of involvement and a whole host of questions about why the attack and why now. Bruce Hoffman is a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations. Bruce, hello to you.
Good morning.
A branch of the Islamic State known as ISIS-K has claimed responsibility for this attack. Who are they?
It's the branch of the Islamic State, which did not disappear in 2018, 2019, despite the defeat and elimination of its caliphate in Syria and Iraq, that has taken root in Afghanistan and is actually nowadays about the most capable and consequential of all the Islamic State branches.
And so for experts like yourself, Bruce, in counterterrorism, was ISIS-K like on the list of your suspects? Like when you heard this news, were you like, oh, I think it might be ISIS-K? And if so, why did you think that?
Number one on my list, I immediately thought so, because this would be the third time in less than a decade that ISIS itself, or the Islamic State itself, or one of its branches, has targeted a concert venue with young people. There was, of course, the attack in Paris in November 2015 of the Bataclan during a heavy metal concert. There was the attack in May 2017 of the Manchester, England arena, where Ariana Grande was about to perform. So this is part of their modus operandi, tragically.
Why concert venues? Why do they pick that as their target?
Generally soft targets, in the sense that they're attended by large numbers of people that you want to get in very quickly. Their bags may be searched to prevent them from bringing in alcohol, but in a terrorism context, weapons or a bomb. It's less expected that armed intruders are going to appear at the scene and then start opening fire. And then one has to say, just like we saw on October 7th in Israel at the Nova Music Festival, these were events populated by young people mainly, and their death and dismemberment and targeting sends a frisson, really, of horror throughout societies. So it's a deliberate tactic, unfortunately, that's becoming more common.
Okay, so now let's talk about ISIS and Russia. Why Russia? Like, why strike there? What is that, I use in quotes, relationship between ISIS and Russia?
Well, we have short memories when it comes to terrorism. In 2014, when ISIS's founder and first emir or leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, declared the caliphate very memorably on July 1st, 2014, he singled out immediately not just the United States, but Russia as one of ISIS's preeminent enemies, and accused Russia of being in league with Jews, the Crusaders, and their allies to oppress Muslims. We have to remember, too, that the world had a remarkably calm interval in terms of successful terrorist attacks on commercial aviation that basically lasted from 2004 until October 2015, when an ISIS branch in the Sinai Peninsula downed a Russian charter flight, killing 224 persons. There's been at least half a dozen attacks that ISIS has staged in Russia since 2016. 20 ISIS members were recently arrested in Russia. So behind the scenes, something that hasn't been reported is ISIS's intense enmity towards Russia.
And then, of course, Russia's involvement in Syria, which ISIS doesn't like very much either.
Absolutely. That's yet another red flag for ISIS. Russia's support of Bashar al-Assad, Russia's support of the forces that are actually battling with ISIS fighters to this day in Syria.
2 weeks ago, the U.S. embassy in Moscow intercepted communications that an attack might be coming. I think it said maybe in 6 months, maybe earlier than that. It warned the Russians about that possibility. It didn't just warn the Russians quietly. It warned them very loudly, very publicly. Why do you believe the Americans did that so publicly, tell the Russians that an attack was likely or possibly coming?
The United States intelligence community has long had a pattern, even a tradition, of warning even enemies of imminent or impending terrorist attacks when they receive that intelligence. Don't forget, in early January, the United States also warned Iran of a planned ISIS attack that actually materialized on the anniversary of the death of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Commander Qasem Soleimani. There were dual suicide attacks at this ceremony that killed 84 persons. So the U.S. twice in the past 3 months has warned other countries that one might assume are enemies of the United States of the danger of a terrorist attack.
Before this attack, there was this nationwide address by President Vladimir Putin describing those warnings that you just talked about there by the U.S. as an attempt at blackmail by the United States. Help me understand why the president of Russia would do that and be so publicly dismissive of this kind of warning.
I'm afraid it's a very sad commentary on the decline of U.S.-Russian relations and trust in one another, that firstly the warning would be dismissed so cavalierly, and then the United States would be blamed for sowing discord. But of course, for Russia, the United States is also an enemy because the United States, as are the rest of NATO and the European Union, are supporting Ukraine in resisting Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
And so how damaging is all this to Putin's reputation inside Russia? That not only has he, you know, he was warned that this could happen, but that it did happen in the capital of his country.
Right. As a dictator, I don't think he has to worry too much about that. Of course, he was just recently, quote unquote, reelected. What is interesting is that the bombing I referred to earlier in Manchester in 2017 occurred just before the British general election. This one occurs right after the Russian, quote unquote, elections. So it's an attempt by terrorist groups to elbow themselves into the limelight and also embarrass whatever government is in office. Yes, it certainly achieved that with someone like Putin, but Putin's a master at deflecting blame and responsibility away from himself.
Russian authorities say 11 people have been detained. The four gunmen, it says, that carried out this attack were caught. ISIS put out some statements and photos of these gunmen claiming their responsibility. But Russian authorities said these four gunmen who were caught were heading to Ukraine. Kyiv says Ukraine had absolutely no involvement in this attack. But of course, Bruce, the backdrop to all of this is the war in Ukraine. How might this attack complicate things?
Well, very clearly, Putin is using it as a justification to ramp up the aggression against Ukraine. And even some oligarch has called for depopulating Ukrainian cities and using hitherto unthinkable weapons. So I think as a further justification or legitimization of Russian brutality in Ukraine, it will be harnessed and exploited to the fullest.
Putin is pledging to track down, punish all those behind these attacks. What do you imagine? You know, today's a national day of mourning, but what do you imagine Russia's response to all of this could look like?
It's convenient, of course, to focus on Ukraine, who Russia is at war with and Russia invaded, because that target, whether it's legitimate or not, the Russians don't care. It just justifies their aggression against Ukraine. And it's a convenient address for the Russians to direct their ire to inflict this punishment. But the real culprit is ISIS. And where do they strike? I mean, where is ISIS-K's, for instance, actual physical facilities in Afghanistan? Are they known to the Russian authorities? Are there the intelligence targeting packages that the Russians could retaliate against the actual group responsible for this attack? That's much more difficult than singling out a country like Ukraine and using it as a justification to ramp up the aggression against Kyiv.
Bruce, thank you for your analysis and assessment this morning. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Bruce Hoffman is a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can find out all the latest on the investigation taking place in Russia by going to our news website, cbcnews.ca. We are living in a world roiled by war, and it can seem on the verge of even greater conflict, depending on the actions and decisions of some rulers. To help make sense of the volatility around us, it can be helpful to look to history, even fairly recent history, for lessons that can inform our path ahead. That's what two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Call does in his latest book. It is called The Achilles Trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. I spoke with Steve Call about it a few days ago. The U.S.-led invasion on Iraq began 21 years ago this month. Broadly, what is the continuing fallout from that war in the Middle East?
Well, it shattered Iraq and set off years of internal conflict, including the rise of the Islamic State. More broadly, it empowered Iran, which managed to influence the Shia majority population in Iraq and extend both the sort of networks and the power that it has developed through proxy groups across the Middle East. Of course, we see this in the headlines today, and Iraq figures in this kind of shadow war between the United States and Iran.
Yeah, wars have long tails, even after the fighting ends. And in that long tail, information drips out, comes out. People like you try to get more information. You got your hands on a lot of new information about the late leader of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and his thinking. So what did you get and what did it reveal to you about his mind, how he thought about things?
Yeah, so the starting point of this project was a question. A lot of us lived through the revelation that the invasion of Iraq had been sold on the basis of Saddam possessing weapons of mass destruction, and that it turned out he didn't have them. And that set off a great reckoning in the United States and in Britain about how this intelligence failure had occurred, how the war had been sold to the public, and so on. But there was another question that was really never asked, and that was, why did Saddam sacrifice his long run in power, his life, ultimately, for the sake of weapons he didn't possess? And this had always seemed to me a big mystery as to why he had behaved the way he did on his side. And then it turned out, I discovered a decade ago, that the question might be answerable because he tape recorded his leadership conversations more assiduously than Richard Nixon. And there were thousands of hours of him talking at pivotal points of this history before the invasion about what he was thinking, how he was handling the Americans, and so forth. And long story short, the records were not available, but I was able to obtain a big batch of them by filing a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Pentagon and combining that with other materials and interviews. I think the purpose is to tell the other side of the origins of the Iraq War and to understand what this dictator, in a very closed system, was thinking at key moments.
Okay, so as you say, it was sort of a mystery. Like, why did this guy do this? He had destroyed his chemical and biological weapons years earlier. Of course, we only found that out subsequent to the invasion. And this mystery, why did he act as though he still had them, even when it all led to the U.S. invasion?
Well, there are several reasons. As you point out, he destroyed them, but he did it in secret and without really even telling a lot of his own generals what he had done in the summer of 1991. And his motivation then was to get out of sanctions, which had been imposed after he invaded Kuwait and which had been tightened and tied to disarmament demands by the UN after the Kuwait war. So summer of 91, he's been thrown out of Kuwait. He's humiliated before the world. You know, inspectors are coming his way to verify his disarmament. And he wants to pass the inspections because he's hoping if he does, then maybe the French, the Russians will help ease the pain that he's suffering under sanctions. But he also doesn't want to admit freely what he has done because, first of all, he was afraid that he might seem vulnerable to his enemies, Iran, Israel, perhaps internal coup makers among his own generals. And he was a very proud man, sought glory in the Arab world, and he refused to be humiliated in front of white-coated inspectors with clipboards verifying that every bolt and screw of his once mighty arsenal had been verifiably dismantled. So he basically tried to finesse the situation, and in doing so, confused everybody, including a lot of his own aides.
And did he think at the time, from what you understand, that okay, but other people are on to me? In other words, the CIA would know that I have destroyed these weapons.
Yes, that view evolved over the course of the 1990s. So he does this initial confusing thing in 1991. It doesn't work. He remains under scrutiny. And at intervals between then and 9/11, he considers whether he should come clean. Should he cooperate further, because he's constantly being asked for greater cooperation. But one of the reasons that he doesn't cooperate, and indeed one of the reasons why he throws all of the inspectors out in 1998, is that he comes to the conclusion, which was consistent with his longstanding beliefs, that of course the CIA is omniscient, and they surely already know that he has destroyed his weapons back in 1991. And so the logic of that is, if the CIA knows, then these accusations that he does possess WMD are just a game. They're just pressure tactics. It's all part of a conspiracy to oust him from power. And of course, he wasn't completely irrational in this belief, because in 1997, the American Secretary of State then, Madeleine Albright, gave a speech and said, no matter what Saddam does, whether he disarms or not, we're not going to give him sanctions relief until he's out of power. So between those overt signals and his belief in a omniscient CIA, he basically concluded, why should I cooperate? It's all a game. I can have sanctions with inspectors running around my country, or I can have sanctions without them. I'd prefer dignity. So he threw them all out.
As you say, it wasn't a total irrational way to think about things. So on the flip side, how come the CIA then didn't know? Like, you have this leader of a country saying, obviously, the CIA would know, but the CIA didn't know, or did they?
No, they didn't know. I know some people, you know, to this day are convinced that they did, but I, you know, I'm just following the evidence. I don't see any evidence at all that there was any dishonesty in the misjudgment that he did have WMD. I mean, after all, in 2003, on the eve of the invasion, even the government of Germany, for example, its intelligence service in Germany was adamantly opposed to the war, but it still thought that Saddam had WMD. And many of the inspectors who were from all kinds of nations believed that he was hiding something in his arsenals. That wasn't the question at the time. It was whether an invasion was a good idea. So the CIA made this misjudgment because it did not have sources or insight inside of Saddam's regime, not the kinds of sources that would have been close enough to him to have a sense of how he had handled all of this. Now, admittedly, he was a hard problem. He ran a police state that was very difficult to penetrate. And even within that police state, he only trusted a handful of people around him. And yet, looking back on it, you can see the folly of some of the policy, which was to isolate him so thoroughly that the United States had basically no contact with him between 1991 and 2003. So they missed a lot of important things that they might have detected if they'd had meetings with him. I mean, for example, by the end, before the invasion, Saddam was now in his 60s. Wasn't the same person he had been a decade ago. He had become obsessed with writing novels. He'd lost interest in military affairs. He was worried that his order to destroy his WMD wasn't being followed, so he kept issuing follow-up directives to his scientists. Now, if we had been in contact with him, maybe we would have picked up on some of these things and asked different questions.
This is interesting. You characterized it as a misjudgment on the Pentagon, on the U.S. government's part. But as you say, there's lots of people who are critical of that kind of view, saying, you know, this was planned out, that the U.S. government just wanted to go into Iraq. So what do you say when someone says that to you, Steve? Like, Steve, this wasn't misjudgment. This was more deliberate than that.
It depends on what you mean. There's a factual question of whether or not the CIA actually believed that Saddam had WMD. And I don't see any evidence otherwise. I think they actually believed he had WMD. Now, that's different from how the war was sold. The White House, taking professional intelligence analysis that was wrong, exaggerated even that analysis and manipulated public opinion by emphasizing a nuclear war threat that, for example, wasn't plausible, even if you thought he might have some kind of nuclear program still active. So I can understand why people feel that they were lied to by their government, but that's a little bit different than saying, well, the people down in the trenches of the bureaucracy whose job was to call balls and strikes about the facts of Iraq's weapons program, they did judge on the basis of the information they had that he had some certainly chemical weapons, biological weapons, and some kind of nuclear program, though they didn't judge that he had a bomb.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Call. He has a new book out. It is called The Achilles Trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. Steve, the 2003 war in Iraq was not the first time conflict has come about through misjudgment, misunderstanding, miscalculation. Why do you think countries and leaders continuously blunder into wars and don't learn the lessons of the past? What's at the heart of that as you see it?
You know, as you mentioned earlier, we live in a kind of a darkening time. And one of its characteristics is the rise of authoritarians and dictatorships and illiberal systems of all kinds. And these leaders, they are self-isolating in order to maintain their security. They don't travel widely. They are given a lot of happy talk within their regime. And they also, have private calculations that are very difficult for their adversaries, such as in the United States, to figure out, to even understand. So I think what's interesting about Saddam's case, and one of the reasons why I worked on the book, was it's rare to have a dictatorship like his so thoroughly documented, to have so much information about exactly how he operated and who he trusted and what he said and how he managed conflicts. And one of the things that I thought coming away from it was, oh, geez, on the basis of what I now see about Saddam's case, I feel confident about only one thing in reference to Vladimir Putin, which is we don't really know what he is calculating. We can see the outlines of it. And look, a lot of what these guys say in public is what they really think. But there are layers and layers behind that public rhetoric that in Saddam's case, really quite surprising. And I'm sure that's true in Putin's case. Now, is the penetration of the Russian system deeper than it was in Saddam's case? Maybe. But I'm not at all sure that's true in China, for example. So first, humility, to answer your question. We have to understand that we will not understand. And then second, a lesson derived from something we were discussing just a minute ago, which is contact. There's a lot of incentive not to talk to enemies if you live in a democratic capital. First of all, your opposition, free speech, they will attack you for it just because it's politics. Also, often these dictators are under international sanctions. And certainly for the Americans, who are often the architects of these sanctions and have the dollar as a weapon, they don't want to weaken the alliance of countries that are willing to go along with these sanctions. And if you start talking to the enemy, well, then countries that might have independent economic reasons not to follow the sanctions are given a reason to step aside. Oh, well, you're engaging now. Well, we want to engage too. So these are reasons why governments don't talk to enemies. But I think the record in Saddam's case suggests that this should be reconsidered, because the costs of self-isolating and not having contact. And I'm not suggesting that, if you call up Kim Jong-un or meet him in Singapore, you're going to solve anything. And this is not necessarily work for presidents or prime ministers to do. But back channels, intelligence channels, constant conversation, it is revelatory. I mean, maybe I'm biased as a journalist because, we talk to everybody, don't we? We talk to people who are in prison. We talk to terrible people who have done terrible things. But we think that there are ways to manage those conversations so that they're still revelatory and in the public interest.
And to that point, there's also this argument, right, like about empathy, and not empathy in the way it's kind of loosely used, like having feelings about it, but to the point that the work that you did, which is like, I'm trying to get into this guy's mindset and his headspace to understand why he did the things he did. Where does empathy in terms of, Western governments trying to understand what motivates our quote unquote enemies, where does that sort of sit?
Yeah, it's important. It's hard. I think, in the case of working on Saddam, I had these materials that wouldn't have been available to any of the presidents prior to his downfall. And yet, I could do this exercise that even without those materials, I could have attempted the exercise that it's very hard for presidents to attempt, which is to empathize with him, as you say, to see the world from his point of view, to look out from his eyes without sanitizing him. In order to do that, though, you do have to suspend a little bit of judgment, and it can be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But I do think it allows you to see behavior that would be otherwise difficult to understand or predict. And then just to make it a little more complicated, when someone like that is nonetheless aggressively dangerous, relying only on your ability to guess at his intentions may also be unwise, because, there is this basic rule in international relations that if you're facing a dangerous adversary and you're trying to defend your own territory, people, you're best off looking at your adversary's capabilities and trying to prepare to defend against those rather than trying to guess at that individual's intentions. I think actual practitioners of this work in our governments, they know that both matter. And so I think where we're much better at managing another country's capabilities, and we're really not very good, at least in the United States, at getting inside intentions.
And, you know, in the 2003 invasion, there was, I'm going to use a very like colloquial term, cherry picking of intelligence, arguably, I understand that, by the U.S. government in the march to war. And I'm wondering, some 20 plus years later, what you think about how likely it is that the same kind of confirmation bias is at work, whether that be the Pentagon, and I heard you when you said I'm making a distinction between the Pentagon and the people that are working at lower levels than the elected leadership, but that idea of confirmation bias as we look to perceived enemies around the world, the Putins, or real enemies, the Putins, President Xi Jinping of China, Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, I think it's a real danger, and it is prevalent down at the working level of intelligence analysts, as well as with elected leaders. You know, there's a certain way that political tides sweep over government and bureaucracy, and groupthink is a product of that. And in the kind of lessons learned internal after-action exercises that followed the disaster in Iraq, there was a lot of recognition that groupthink had been one of the problems. And so these bureaucracies try to set up solutions like what they call red teams, a group of analysts who are protected and empowered to go off by themselves and think completely differently from all of their colleagues, just try to imagine radically alternative scenarios from the prevailing assumptions. Now, I'm not aware that formalizing that exercise necessarily produces better results. But I can see that at least we should, as an open society, be attempting such alternative approaches that are based on our own strength, which is openness and at least in theory, the freedom to say uncomfortable things and to speak truth to power. So the reason those things matter is because of the problem. And the problem is political conformity and the way that seeps into even supposedly nonpartisan civil services, where everybody has an incentive to advance their career to make sure that the politicians that they're briefing, you know, aren't upset by the message that they're receiving.
And as we talk about these issues of, you know, lack of understanding, the misjudgments, the empathy piece, you've been covering the Israel-Hamas war, writing about it for The New Yorker. And so as you sort of think through those big themes, how important are those to sort of understanding this particular conflict at this particular time, a very, very divisive conflict?
I think for most of us, the central fact of the conflict is the humanitarian disaster in Gaza and the enormous toll that the war has taken on Palestinian civilians there. If it's necessary, we should all be pushing ourselves to really sit still inside the experiences of powerless, ordinary Gazans who are scrapping even now for food and water. Stepping back from that observation, you know, my work is more about decision making and about governments. And there, I think we have a conflict that arose from a black box on the Hamas side. I have no idea how to understand the origins of the October 7th attack. I think, you know, there was some initial reporting about planning and, you know, where this design came from and what actually happened on the 7th from Hamas's side. But, you know, their leadership has been on the run ever since, and maybe we'll never really understand that. But, you know, Hamas is a fact of life, and I wish we had better reporting of its leadership and decision-making and the factions within its leadership and how they are wrestling with their own position after nearly 6 months of war. So, yes, I think it's still highly relevant.
Do you believe that Western leaders should be, you know, trying to talk to Hamas? Of course, Hamas goes through Qatar in those sort of conversations. But do you think some more direct diplomacy, given, again, what you've learned in sort of looking at the invasion of Iraq, is perhaps the step forward that needs to be taken at this point?
You know, before October 7th, we all understood that Hamas was a complicated organization, a listed terrorist group designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Britain. I don't know about Canada, but
Canada as well.
In any event, Canada as well. So unlike, say, Al-Qaeda, it had a political wing. It had social services in Gaza. It ran the administration. So there were doctors and accountants and lots of other people who might accommodate Hamas, might be quote-unquote card-carrying members of Hamas, but they were also civil servants and they might have been accommodating their sort of authoritarian leadership because that was the way to get a paycheck. So in that context, talking to their political wing or just dealing with the fact that they had political and social service infrastructure was necessary for the international community, even while trying to hold them accountable for their violence. And October 7th was a pivot point in the history of Hamas, as well as in many other ways. And where I would hesitate is to, I haven't really given much thought to what emerges from this war on Hamas's side of the equation. And I think it's very much still a war that is unfinished.
For many people, the war in Iraq, the 2003 war, is a fading memory for some of our younger listeners. They weren't even alive during this. So as you now in 2024 look to the war in Europe, Russia and Ukraine, the Middle East, in Sudan, what is the big tent cautionary tale that leaders today should learn from 2003?
Well, it's the law of unintended consequences and the trap of preventive war. I think those are the main lessons of the Iraq case for the United States and for the allies, you know, that followed into Iraq, and for all of the world that had to deal with the mess that arose. The Bush administration had, you know, failed to plan for the war, but its original sin was the conviction that Iraq could not be deterred, could not be contained, despite there not really being evidence of imminent aggression by Saddam Hussein. And no matter how dark a view you took of him, and he certainly had earned lots of skepticism and more, he was the architect of terrible war crimes. Nonetheless, this idea that there was such a thing as a preemptive war that could be executed swiftly and with minimal costs following on seemed absurd at the time, and in hindsight offers, you know, an enduring cautionary lesson for statecraft.
Steve Hall, appreciate your time and your thinking analysis on this. It's been good to hear from you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That is Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Steve Call. His latest book is called The Achilles Trap. And that's it this week here on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. We had additional help this week from digital producer Sheena Goodyear. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I am Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you so very much for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.